Praveen Mohan is known worldwide for his research into the symbology of ancient temples around the world. His archaeological and spiritual quest has taken him to Peru, Indonesia, but focuses chiefly on the ancient treasures to be found in India. He has guested on History Channel's Ancient Aliens and has built his own platform to some 4 million subscribers across 4 languages.
Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 3 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
You mentioned earlier your trip to Indonesia, which is quite recent, and while you were there, you went to the Candi Suku Temple, which is an extraordinary place. And my jaw dropped when I saw you walk around this place because it really is an anomaly. It portrays long-skulled people, such as you might find in ancient Peru, the Paracas skulls, or in Egypt with the way some of the pharaohs were portrayed, with the false beard that was Egyptian fashion as well. You've got a portrayal of the Ark of the Covenant, it looks like, which is the Hebrew tradition, Hebrew scriptures. You've got a Mayan-style pyramid. I mean, it looks like a religious Disneyland, that it seems to be a theme park of world thought and world religion. That's a lot of cultural knowledge in one place. Now, I was interested to know, what is the date of that place for that knowledge all to have come together? Does it reflect an ancient global culture, or was this simply put together by someone who is very well traveled? What do you make of it? It's an extraordinary place. What do you make of it?
So there is an interesting story about the Candi Suku Temple, because before I went to Indonesia, I checked with David Childress, and we have all these great temples in these big cities like Yogyakarta. But David Childress is like, no, don't go to these touristic temples. Go to the site called Candi Suku and then tell me what you think, right? Because he has already researched about Candi Suku. So I went to Candi Suku. It's a very difficult place to reach. It's on a place, it's on kind of like a mountainous area, and the roads are really narrow. So when we went to the Candi Suku temple, our jaws were just dropping on the floor, because this temple in a remote part of Indonesia has a pyramid, okay? And this pyramid looks very much like the Mayan pyramid of Chichen Itza. Now, the thing is it related to the Mayans? But when we look at the carvings, we look at carvings that are very similar to Hindu carvings as well, because we can see gods like Ganesha there, the elephant god there. So it looks very similar to the Hindu gods as well. And then, more interestingly, like when I started to really look at the carvings, I realized that their heads were not normal. Okay, they had real elongated skulls. And we're not talking about just one or two statues. We're talking about like dozens and dozens of carvings, which really had like elongated skulls. there, you know, there is a lot of controversy about these elongated skulls. Some people say, okay, so they were just doing head binding, because some tribes do head binding and they're able to kind of like modify the skull. But I found one more detail that was, that completely nails this, because these are not humans. They had holes outside of their earlobe. They had one near the temple here, and then they had one behind the earlobe. And we're not, again, we're not talking about one carving. We can see the same detail in all the carvings. These carvings are shown with elongated skulls. And the sculptors, I mean, this is where it's really interesting, right? The sculptors wanted to tell us that this species had this detail that was that's not present in humans. So, which is why they painstakingly put these holes outside the ears. So this clearly proves that these were not humans. And the carvings show like really interesting details. You can see signs of torture. There was some conflict going between them. And so, another very interesting thing, I don't know if I can say this in your channel. I mean, I certainly got in trouble for saying it in my channel. They demonetized some of my videos.
We can edit it for YouTube, probably.
Cool, but I know some of your patrons may be watching on your website. Now, another key detail, these are anatomical details we're talking about, right? So, for example, if there was a man walking with like five eyes, you're not going to be like, okay, he's just human. Because humans don't get to have like five eyes, right? So this detail of like elongated head, elongated skull, and then these holes, you know, up and down the earlobe. On top of this, there are several carvings shown with four testicles. It's a remarkable detail. It's clearly shown, not just in, again, not just in one carving. They're showing it again and again in these carvings, which means that we're clearly looking at a species that's not human.
Yes. And these beings that you're describing with the reptilian-style face, the elongated skull, the hole in the skull above the ear, they are the power people depicted here, and they're in power over the humans. And so the $64,000 question is, are these extraterrestrials? And were they governing over our ancestors in the deep past? Is that the story we're being told?
I certainly think so. I certainly think that once upon a time, extraterrestrials came to our planet. And just like what Elon Musk is planning to do, you know, 20 years from now, they came to Earth. And I mean, I just visualized the scenario of what would happen if Elon Musk goes to a distant planet. Let's say we call it Planet X. And then there are like cavemen living there, right? So Elon Musk will just land in that Planet X. He'll just have everything, right? So if they come to attack him, he'll just use a laser gun and kill them. He can just click the lighter and make fire, right? And the caveman will just think of him as a god. The caveman will be like, okay, how is this guy able to just take something out of his pocket and eat it, right? We have to fish and we have to go hunting for like a whole day to find food. How is he able to do it? How is he able to make fire with just clicking his hand? How is he able to just kill a person by just pulling a trigger, right? So to those people, he's going to just look like a god. And this is exactly what I think happened many thousands of years ago. And I think people would have observed these extraterrestrials or gods coming and landing on our planet.
Yes. I mean, that story echoes in ancestral stories all around the world. You can hear it in the ancient Mesopotamian stories. It's buried there in the stories of the Bible. You go to African story in Nigeria, listen to the Yoruba people, the Edo people, the Efik people. They all have a version of this story. And for me, it's the correlations that, that make me take it really seriously. I think we were visited. I think we were adapted in the deep past. And in some of the other temples you visited, you found stories of that seem to represent people being engineered artificially. We talked about the gestation pod, for instance, that you found in one temple. Is it a kumbha, it's called?
Yes. It's called a kumbha, yes. Yes, we do. There's a lot of carvings in Hindu temples that show evidences of very advanced, like, medical technology. For example, in many Hindu temples, you will see a sperm swimming towards the egg or ovum, and it's just getting ready to, you know, to go into it, right, and make a zygote and start life. This is a very popular carving, and you can see this in many ancient Hindu temples, more than 1,000 years old, okay? And these carvings should not be there because we did not invent the microscope until the last 500 years. We're not supposed to see these single-cell organisms, right? But we do see them. And we also see cell division. These carvings show step-by-step how one cell divides into two and then becomes into four. We're literally able to go from pillar to pillar looking at how a single cell transforms into a big organism, okay? And it's really interesting because why do we see these carvings, right? If we see these carvings in, let's say, Egypt or Greece, we may not be able to understand that fully, but when we look at ancient Indian texts, these texts talk about test tube babies. These texts talk about how in ancient times, they were making babies outside the human body. Okay, this is called drona. So the test tubes were called something like dronas, and they could do it outside the body. They could literally do this kind of in vitro fertilization. Today we do this in a petri dish, right? So we take the sperm and the ovum and then we artificially do it. And this technology was talked about in ancient times. And then, but today we don't have these gestation pods yet. Okay, so typically what happens today is you'll have IVF or in vitro fertilization. And then after, you know, the cell starts, the zygote starts developing to a certain level, you go and put it back into the woman's womb. That's how we do it, right? But ancient Indian texts have taken it like one step further. They talk about a gestation pod that's built completely outside. So the woman doesn't have to do anything. So the baby completely goes inside the, grows inside the gestation pod. And they talk about how to provide nutrition to the fetus, okay? So you think about that. So they talk about like how we maintain the kumbha. So how are we supposed to maintain the temperature? Like how, what kind of nutrition goes into this kumbha, okay? Now, we have not completely achieved this yet, but since this is going to be on YouTube, this is what, 2024, I will bet you in 50 years, let's say 2075, there's going to be a lot of people who are using external gestation pods. A lot of people are not able to hold the baby. They're not, their wombs are not strong enough, and they're all going to move towards these gestation pods. And 100 years from now, a woman who actually delivers a baby naturally is going to, you know, be the headline in newspapers. Because people, even today, even having like a normal delivery, like not doing a C-section, is becoming really rare. So in 50 years and 100 years, people will completely move towards these external gestation pods. And think about it. Is it just a coincidence? Is it just fantasy that ancient Indian texts were mentioning the exact same technology. Absolutely not. I think such kind of technology definitely existed in ancient times. And we have carvings that support this. And we also have texts that support this.
So Praveen, what's the age of the texts that talk about these technologies?
We're talking, for example, the texts of Ramayana, at least 2,000 years old. Okay.
And when they talk about these technologies, is it your view that it's describing the technology of the gods, so to speak, of the extraterrestrial visitors, or was it human technology at that time that's since been lost?
This is a good question, which I don't know the answer to yet. So a part of the confusion is in understanding, okay, which one is a god and which one is a human? Because they, at some point, they become really intertwined.
Yes.
We don't know who is human and who is god. And they talk about a civilization that kind of blends both of them together. And hence, yes, the arrival of Nephilim or giants.
In
Indian texts, they clearly mention the giants.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that they're always shown as a hybrid between humans and gods.
Exactly. Yes, you find the same in the Bible, in Genesis 6. You find the same in the Sumerian story. Gilgamesh, of course, was a giant. And it is the result of hybridization. And the fact that that story repeats around the world, for me, that's a bit of a smoking gun. But in terms of distinguishing human from gods, there is a kind of entity that gets mentioned around the world that is described in very distinct physical terms as being reptilian and feathered. So you've got the feathered serpents of Mesoamerica. You have feathered serpents in the biblical story. Feathered serpents exist in China. Can you tell me, how do the Serpa and the Nagas fit into that picture in the world of Hinduism?
There's a lot of material about Sarpa, which is obviously related to the word seraph.
Yes.
And then serpent.
And they're
all coming from the same root. That's really obvious. They're more commonly known as Nagas in India. And the thing is, these Nagas live underground, according to ancient Hindu texts. These Nagas live in like a subterranean world. And these Nagas are still considered very powerful gods. There's a lot of people who worship these serpentine gods. We have a lot of people who claim that they're descendants of these serpentine gods. A lot of people say, okay, so I'm only partly human. The other part of me, my great-great-great-great-grandfather was a Naga. The classic example, we have certain tribes called Nagas in India and Sri Lanka as well, who claim that they're descendants of these Nagas. In Cambodia, if you just go to Wikipedia and see the origin of Cambodian civilization, the very first queen mentioned is actually not human. She's a Naga. She comes from somewhere, and she actually founds that civilization that transforms humanity. So we do have some strong evidence that Nagas were these reptilian beings, very powerful, and they're able to do things like shape-shifting, for example. Mm-hmm. They're able to transform and create illusions. They're capable of flight, and they usually live underground. And Nagas are also credited with building many megalithic structures. People do worship, a lot of people worship Nagas, especially in South India, it's very common because they believe that the Nagas are listening to us when we're talking. The Nagas are always listening to us, and they can help us if we ask them.
I find it fascinating how strongly that correlates with stories around the world. The origins of the kings, for instance, so many cultures claim that the authority of their kings was derived from the non-human kings who preceded them. That's even built into the story of the British royal family. If you research the Stone of Scone, for instance, the Stone of Destiny. So it's a really universal story. It's fascinating. But there was something else I was going to ask you about that slipped my mind. It might come back to me in a minute. So while I'm waiting to remember that, I'll ask you something else. On a lighter note, if you go to ancient Armenia, lower Mesopotamia, Bolivia, Ecuador, you will find gods wandering around with a handbag. And people speculate as to why they're all carrying this same handbag, what is in it. And what I've heard from you is really interesting because you found some carvings in India that are not quite handbags, but might give us an insight as to what could have been in the mystery object. What are your thoughts on that, Praveen?
Okay, so, like you said, you know, we find these handbags in places like Armenia, especially in Sumerian carvings. You always find these gods holding a handbag. There are a couple of places where I've found this handbag in India. And the first one is a place called Gangaikonda Cholapuram. And that handbag is kind of like put up on a tree branch. It's just hanging from a tree branch there. Somehow, the carvings I've seen, I've never seen a handbag placed on the ground, which seems to be very odd to me, okay? Which seems to imply there's some kind of a power source, right? Well, we normally don't put, until the last 30, 40 years ago, we're not allowed to put batteries, like the big, like a car battery, for example. We're not allowed to put it on the ground because it just starts to drain quicker because of the earth. Which makes me wonder if it's some type of a power source. There is another temple called Avriya Temple, which showed more than a couple of handbags. It's very interesting because only this temple called the Avriya Temple shows the handbag open. Okay, we can actually see what's inside the handbag. Okay, but again, this is kind of a bummer because inside the handbag, there seems to be like more containers. Okay, yes. There are like two bottles in there with seem to have the lids intact. There are two bottles and there's like an arc-like instrument there. So we don't know what they are. Like now we start to move from like what's in the handbag to like what's in the bottle.
Yeah, what's in the jar. Yeah.
Right. So, but they did use the handbags. And it's interesting because they clearly show, right, these guys are shown in the middle of a battlefield.
Okay? That's right. I'd forgotten that detail.
And that's what's interesting, right? So if you're going into a battlefield, you're not going to be like, okay, I'm just going to take a bottle of like apple juice, right? You won't do that. You're going in there with only the most important stuff, right? Because it's a battlefield, right? You're not going to be like, okay, let me just take like a Snicker bar or like some chocolate bar or something like that. So you're going to take only the important stuff. And he's taking that handbag. And inside that handbag, he has two containers and like an arc-like thing. Of course, that I haven't solved that mystery because now I have to go and look for the carving, see what's inside that
jar.
In
the jar. All right. Praveen, I will ask you again in another year or so and see if you've found out more on that. People want to know. Now, I want to come back to the spiritual aspect of your quest because one of the things I love about what you're doing is that it's not information just for information's sake. It's part of a much deeper quest for you. And I know that you've sat and studied at the feet of masters of siddhas and sadhus, and you've seen some things. And so I want to ask you about that bigger journey you've been making, and ask, from all the things you've seen in temples and from sitting at the feet of masters, have your beliefs changed? Have your beliefs about human beings changed, and what's possible for us?
I believe that we haven't fully understood ourselves, and we've just gone like really far away from our initial quest, which is mastery of self, which is reaching enlightenment, which is achieving eternal peace. I think we're moving more and more towards more conflict. People have become more evil. Again, this is all mentioned in ancient texts. This is called the Kali Yuga in ancient Hindu texts, where people start to become more and more evil rather than understand their problems and try to solve them, achieve happiness. And I have gone to like really remote places. I worked with a lot of siddhas or these masters, and they seem to have transcended all these little things. They don't care about all these petty matters. They are quite devoid of anger or fear, or you know, the worries. You know something has happened in the past and it still bogs you down every day, and you're going to carry that for the rest of your life. And these masters don't have any of that. And they're able to achieve this kind of a mental state through meditation. And mostly they live reclusive lives. I do, and this is why you don't see me. Sometimes you see I don't make a video for like 2 months. I'm just gone because I'm in a completely remote place where we're not allowed to have cell phones. There'll be no connectivity. And we're doing, we're doing certain rituals to kind of enhance your mental state. So we do a lot of that. A lot of this is also done in secrecy. We're not supposed to talk about this, but we do recreate ancient rituals. The ancient people around the world, not just in India, the ancient people around the world were much, much happier. And they had tranquility, and we somehow seem to have lost all that. I don't think human beings are supposed to have that kind of, this level of conflict. Yes. Is just insane, I think. And it's good because, I mean, luckily I found, this as my passion, going to the temples, working with all these people who are quite spiritual. So it does bring me a lot of happiness. It's definitely brought me peace. I was able to definitely get rid of all the negative emotions. I don't hold, these silly grudges or like worries and all that stuff. This is definitely brought on by these sites and these people I work with.
Now, a lot of people listening will say, I love the sound of that, and I certainly need to de-stress myself and to move away from heavier emotions, as Plato called them, and get rid of all my wounds and resentments and anguish and unforgiveness. But I have 3 kids to look after. I have a job to maintain. I would love to go away for 2 months and meditate and sit at the feet of a master. But what can I do in my mainstream employed life that can begin to move in the direction that Praveen is describing?
Well, I don't have an answer to that. I should be selfish and say, watch Praveen Mohan channel.
Well, that's good advice. That is good advice.
But yeah, the thing is, what we do a lot of stuff, but it's really intense. A lot of people come to me and say, okay, what are you selling, right? Are you, can you take us on like a spiritual tour for like a week and we'll pay you big bucks? We don't run tours like that. It's a big industry, as you may as well know. A lot of my friends, Hugh Newman, who I met last week, he was in India. He also does tours like that. A lot of this is also connected with spirituality. They'll be sitting together in an ancient temple chanting a mantra, and then they'll go to like a yoga retreat for one day. And they completely, it does work. It does de-stress you. But unfortunately, I'm just too dumb for all that. I'm just going to, I haven't made any money out of this. I'm just going to the temples, mostly because I don't think, if I wanted to make a ton of money, I would just go back to the United States, you know, making it's not a big deal for me, but I think I'm trying to crack the code of what it is. There is still a lot of missing pieces in the puzzle that we're not understanding. I think only in the last 10 years, I've kind of scratched the surface of all these carvings, these texts. But I believe if I do it for another 5 or 10 years, we may be able to make a significant step forward in really understanding what it is.
Yes. Yes. Well, Praveen, I think you are making this journey on a lot of people's behalf. And I'm watching with bated breath as you continue. If I were to save up and be able to come over to India and say, Praveen, take me to the one temple that you think is going to be most mind-blowing for me, where would you take me? What would you show me?
I would take you to this temple, which we only found out last week. This is a temple called Mandagapattu. This is a cave temple. This is the oldest monolithic cave temple built in southern India. This is about 1,400 years ago. The specialty of this temple is that it's built with a negative construction technique. Now, what's a negative construction technique, right? So when we talk about constructing a temple, when we talk about constructing a temple or a house or an office, what do you think about, right? So you start from the ground level and you start adding materials to it, and then you construct the structure. Now, this is the positive construction technique. But this temple at Mandagapattu was built with a negative construction technique, meaning that nothing was added to it to create this temple. There was this giant rock. It looks almost like a giant hill. And then the architect did not add anything, but just started to scoop the granite out of this giant rock. Okay, he must have scooped tons and tons of rocks. And then what you're looking at is created because of the removal of materials. And what he's done is very strange. He has not put any statues there. There's nothing inside. The three chambers are completely empty, okay? But there is an inscription that says this temple is dedicated to Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. It does mention three gods, the three main gods of Hinduism, but the chambers are actually empty. So which makes us wonder, are these statues invisible? Because we don't see any sign of destruction there. It doesn't appear that these statues were destroyed. The inscription says there are three statues, but there are no statues there. So it seems very interesting to me because this temple was built with negative construction technique, and then it has these invisible statues in these chambers. And then another really important detail is that The inscription says nothing is added to this, okay? This is a key part of the inscription. But you can see these slots on these chambers for doors. Okay? So the doors must have been put there. But according to the inscription, you cannot add anything, right? So that door must have also been like a megalithic door carved out of the bedrock. It's just mind-boggling to me if that's even possible. Okay? I don't know if you went to like Coral Castle in Florida. Did you?
No, I haven't seen that place. But okay. You wrote about this, didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I wrote a book about it. It's a good one. And I think we taught there. He built two doors. One was a 9-ton door. Another one was like a 3-ton door made out of rock. The 3-ton door still works. If you go to Coral Castle, you can still like move it. Okay. So the 9-ton door doesn't. So because it's kind of jammed. But the thing is, at least we know that that's possible. Right. So we can see that that's possible. Yes. And we have in a place called Chennakeshava Temple, you can see a rotating pillar. It's a giant pillar. It's a giant pillar weighing tons. And this is a rotating pillar. And now we can see more. There's an entire lingam which you can rotate in India. And we're talking about ancient temples here. So this kind of building megalithic doors, like movable parts, is like really interesting to me, which makes me wonder if Mandagapattu had this kind of technology, right? They must have had these stone doors, right? Moving stone doors made out of the same rock. So Mandagapattu is a very interesting site. I'll leave some of this kind of unsaid, but it's also like a hanging temple. It's not started from the top and also not started from the bottom. So there are only two ways you can make a monolithic temple. You cannot build it in any other way. So one way is you start from the top of the mountain and you go inside. And this is called cut out rock technology.
Yes.
Okay, this is found in Kailasa Temple in Ellora Caves. This is found in Vettuvan Kovil in Tamil Nadu. There's one more rock cutting technique where you find a giant rock and you start going like this from the ground level, okay? Then you make it into like a nice temple, okay? But the Mandagapattu temple, what's strange is that these guys didn't start from the top and they also did not start from the bottom. Somehow they started like maybe like 8 feet from the ground level. So how did they even do that, right? Were they like kind of hanging and carving this? Like, we don't understand. And this is an extraordinary temple, which Hugh and I just visited like a week ago.
Wonderful. Well, Praveen, you've got me saving up for that trip. You've whetted my appetite. What kind of, are you getting pushback from people in India for the work that you're doing, or is it all encouragement?
We won't. I mean, definitely not, right? If 100% of Indians or 100% of the people around the world were encouraging me, then I'm definitely doing something wrong, right? Right? I should be like selling ice cream or something like that, right? Right? I mean, this is actually how I estimate how powerful the content is. If I don't get any criticism for like 6 months, then I actually stop and say, okay, I'm doing something wrong, right?
Yes.
Because I
relate
am supposed
to that.
Yeah,
I can relate to that for sure.
Absolutely, right? So we are going to do that, right? We are all going to face this kind of criticism because the mainstream media, the mainstream narrative, it's so like rampant and it's also has such deep foundation. So in case of anything, right? So I don't know if you heard of like William Harvey, right? There was this guy called William Harvey. This is a doctor who found out that the heart pumps blood to the human body, right? And he had to go to great lengths to prove this, right? So he found a person who was dying in an accident, and then he had to like cut open the body and show that the heart was pumping out blood. But guess what? All the doctors who lived around his time refused to accept it, right? Because if they accepted it, they had to throw away all the books and all the procedures and everything that they were following until then, right? So whenever we come with something new, you're always going to see a lot of criticism. And then this is exactly what we should be doing, right? We're like, Tony was telling me that, you know, we're talking about UFO stuff. Same thing happened with us when we were doing the UFO stuff in the US. In the US, the great thing is like every town has like a UFO society, and we'd go and be a part of that society. And then we talk about the UFO stuff. And when we posted this UFO materials to places like Facebook, they would delete our content. They would think that, okay, this is a conspiracy theory. This is not real, right? But today, this UFO stuff is considered real. All the governments are starting to accept that, yes, you're, of course, you know, like, I mean, the universe is so large, we can't be the only intelligent life. I mean, that's just common sense. But we had to fight an uphill battle for many decades.
Yes.
So I will. I mean, I hope I get more backlash, but that's just going to happen.
That's how it goes.
Same thing with UFO, right? But what the people like Bob Lazar, you know what happened to him? They just thought he was crazy when he was talking about UFOs. They just laughed at him, right? But today, people have accepted, yeah, I mean, he was right. And he was just like way ahead of his time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Praveen, it's 2024. What does this year hold for you? What are you up to? And how can people keep up with your work?
I have a bunch of temples that I have to go to. We're focusing in India and we're focusing in Southeast Asia. We're going to a bunch of different temples. We're trying to find the true history of these ancient builders, like what were they trying to do and stuff like that. So I have at least about 20 to 30 different temples that I have to visit and research in India and Southeast Asia. And that's basically it. So, I mean, this is the part where Paul is asking me, like, what are you selling, Praveen? Are you selling a book? Or are you selling like a meditation course? Are you selling like tours? Like Praveen Mohan is just too dumb to do all that. So I'm just basically putting out all the materials I find online. It's just 100% free for you. If you just search for my name, Praveen Mohan, you can find me on YouTube. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Instagram. You'll find all my videos, all my pictures just thrown out for free. You can just support me by just simply giving me a like, subscribe. More importantly, if it helps you, if it inspires you to do your own research, that would be fantastic. Because what we do need, like what's the need of the hour, is just more people with open minds. Like we don't want people who are like really dogmatic. We want people with an open mind just coming out and saying, okay, let's just explore this area. Let's just try to understand our past much better, right? So according to scientists, what Homo sapiens start, what, like 200,000 years ago or something like that? Right. Mm-hmm. And we only have documented history of like 5,000 years.
Yes.
So that's like, that's the percentage, right? So of history that we know about. So there is a huge portion that we don't know anything about. So if we just get more people rallying up for this cause, that'll be awesome. Hopefully, man, I shape up and I write a book or something next year. So I feel embarrassed to tell you I got nothing to sell.
That's wonderful. Praveen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. I think that's a great note to conclude on. It's been a pleasure. I hope you'll join us again sometime. But thank you today for joining us on The Fifth Kind.
Oh, pleasure is all mine, man. I had a great conversation. I hope that your viewers also like this content, appreciate it. It was an absolute pleasure. I mean, this is the first time we're talking to each other, and I feel like I've known you for a long time. So thanks a lot.
I feel the same.
So, yeah,
the feeling is absolutely mutual. Thank you. All the best.
Absolute pleasure. All right. Thank you. Bye.
If you enjoy our content here on Fifth Kind TV and would like to support our work, please would you consider subscribing to our new website, fifthkind.tv. Here we will have our full catalog of material along with exclusive access to interviews and documentary content. Sign up today, become part of the community, become part of the conversation. Thank you so much for your support, and I'll see you there.